And we will be sticking to that very strictly because there's so many people that wish to talk. You'll hear a buzzer, and if you're like me, the hearing isn't always what it should be. So if you keep going, I will start going like this. So I'll do a visual and as well as the auditory one. And we do, given the nature of a lot of people with gray hair, we do turn the audio up on the beeper. We realized for a while not everybody was hearing the beeper. So, and again, I apologize in advance if I don't say your name correctly. In my world, if everybody was named Smith, it would be a lot easier for me. But with that, I will call you up three at a time, and just it'll keep going in a rotation. So I will start with Kimberly Polari, Darian Davis, and Pat Hesselgeiser, please. So Kimberly, you will start us off. And please introduce yourself and speak into the mic, please, so we have it recorded. Is that on?
Yeah. Hello?
Yep. Now we have your attention.
Now we have, hello. Hello, thank you, members of the commission, for this opportunity. Thank you for all the volunteers that have showed up to support Heaven's Sakes facility. I'm a little nervous. This is the first time I've ever done this. My name is Kimberly Polari, and I want the commission to know that there are many, many other volunteers who could not be here today that support for Heaven's Sakes. I'm a citizen of Rochester. I've been a volunteer for Heaven's Sakes for over 2 years. I am here of my own accord, and I speak from my personal experience, and these opinions are my own. For Heaven's Sakes holds a special place for me. I had an accident 2 years ago that almost took my life. It was then I realized how important and precious all life is and began volunteering. I've been both a volunteer at the facility directly. I've worked also directly with Claudia and David. I've worked on special projects, and I've dealt directly with the wildlife itself. I've also been a financial supporter by donating supplies and raising money, going so far as to having a combined fund drive deduction for my paycheck. I am a state employee, and I am proud of it. With that being said, when For Heaven's Sakes was treated with such disrespect by DFW, I was embarrassed to be a state employee. I couldn't believe it when I'd heard they'd killed the animals for no other investigative, and there was no other investigative work. There had been a process in place for releasing these deer back into the wild that has worked and has been in place for years at this facility. It requires time, which is something that the DFW didn't give them. Volunteers have given so much of their time preparing these animals for release, and it was a slap in the face to each one of us when they came in and did what they did. I felt like our work didn't matter, and this was just wrong on many levels. Keep in mind, in August, Rochester had a Scatter Creek fire. As many of you are well aware, I've been displaced from my home, and I'm now in a dispute between the insurance company and restoration company for that, and with no end in sight. And the reason why I mention that is because I feel like I'm fighting two battles here. My home is under attack, and now my volunteer work. So this has really hit home for me. Since these events have happened, other wildlife rescues are afraid that it will happen to them. This is a direct correlation of the actions of the DFW. Their harsh and confrontational tactics are beginning to have widespread repercussions. If these places are shut down, it will have significantly damaging effects to the communities and even law enforcement. I personally have been involved when a police officer brings in a wounded animal. Our communities cannot afford to lose any of these places. Claudia and David have given their lives to this work. At the orientation, it's clear that the goal is to return these animals to the wild. Please consider an overhaul to the WAC that is pertaining to rehabilitation. Give these facilities a chance to defend themselves against reports that are clearly wrong and unbiased. Ultimately, DFW has the obligation of the taxpayers to make this right and be accountable for decisions not being made in a vacuum. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kimberly. And And another, please, we've encountered this before. I know all this is passionate. We've been doing this on a lot of issues. We're passionate, is it? But applause, this isn't appropriate. This is a public hearing and all of that. So we understand, but please keep your applause in a silent way. So Dean Finnerly, please, and Darian.
Thank you. Good morning, Commission. My name is Darian Davis. I'm in charge of watershed protection for the City of Seattle, the Cedar River, and South Fork Tolt watersheds. And I'm here today to adamantly oppose some sport fishing rule simplification that we managed to find out about, specifically Section 271-174 impacting Rattlesnake Lake. So in context, the Cedar River and South Fork Tolt watersheds provides drinking water for 1.4 million. It is the largest water supplier in the entire state. And Rattlesnake Lake is part of that outside the hydrographic boundary, but it does have direct groundwater influence. So we have significant risks, which is potential petroleum spills, visitor safety for excessive speed, limited facilities for boat trailers, and the visitor experience degradation. So as a partner with WDFW, we're extremely disappointed that Seattle Public Utilities was not even contacted regarding this change, and there are no other enforceable regulations that prohibit any sort of internal combustion motors on the lake itself, which is very small. And overall, looking at some of the proposed changes and the existing, WDFW is inconsistent in the application of rules pertaining to the use of internal combustion motor use. So we have that concern as well. So I'm here just to document our concerns and the risks that are present. And we would like that section reinstated and not deleted. It is subsection B that I'm specifically referring to within that section. Thank you.
That was noted, Joe, I guess. Okay, thank you. Yes.
How many acres? What is the acreage size of this lake?
It fluctuates, if anybody's been there before, based upon how the moraine is leaking. So anywhere from 40 to 60 acres, surface acre size. And this is a much-loved facility, as many people know.
So you object to internal combustion engines. What about electric motors?
That is fine. We currently have that in use.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. And Paul Michalowski, did I do that right?
Yeah, very good.
That's my Detroit upbringing.
My name is Pat Hessel-Gesser. I am would like to thank the commissioners for this opportunity to speak. I am here today to speak in support of Trout Unlimited's November 10th, 2017 petition to amend the agency rule WAC Chapter 220 through 660. I represent Trout Unlimited as a member and also as the newly formed advocacy committee. As an avid fly fishing enthusiast and outdoors person, I feel this petition is of critical importance for maintaining the health of our rivers, creeks, their habitat, and the environment. Making changes to the current practices for motorized suction dredge mining is critical. While I realize we must all share in the use of public lands and we are not asking for a moratorium, I also recognize as a state we must take responsibility and be accountable for the stewardship of those lands. And most of that weighs heavy and burdensome on you. Currently, Washington, we feel, is experiencing an increase in the out-of-state residents seeking to use motorized suction dredge mining for gold in our rivers and streams. This is a result of the wise actions taken by our neighboring states. Regulation to protect critical habitat and comply with federal ESA and Clean Water Act compliance is needed in our state. As a retired healthcare professional and a provider in the field of neurology, I felt there was a real need for me to investigate the scientific data supporting my comments. After countless hours of literature review, I found a significant amount of evidence-based literature to support that this type of suction dredge mining practice in our state does, in fact, have a negative impact on our water, our fish, the critical habitat for spawning, other aquatic life, and the surrounding environment. Additionally, this practice may pose a very real health risk for humans as it relates to contaminants in the water that is mobilized through the practice of mining. These include mercury, lead, copper, zinc, and even pesticides if the mining is taking place in an agricultural vicinity where pesticides have been used in the past. In conclusion, I urge you, not only as a member of Trout Unlimited, but just as a fly fishing resident in the state of Washington who enjoys our out of doors, to take this petition seriously, do the right thing, and amend the agency rule. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Streif. Jan White, please. And Dean?
Yes, thank you. Good morning. My name is Dean Finnerty, and I'm the Northwest Director for the Ordinance Conservation Project with Trout Unlimited. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to voice my support for the Trout Unlimited November petition for rulemaking to amend the rules of Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife concerning hydraulic project approval statutes. As you're aware, there have been millions of dollars of taxpayer revenue invested in salmon, trout, and steelhead habitat across the state of Washington. These investments were made to protect iconic fisheries that Washington is known for. ESA-listed fish populations require protection under state and federal law. The current rules for suction dredge mining are woefully inadequate to provide the agency with the tools for tracking suction dredge activity, as well as provide adequate accountability. Trout Unlimited is not seeking a ban from suction dredge mining activities. A simple permit system similar to what neighboring states have to ensure compliance with the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act is what is desperately needed in Washington. Failing to make these very basic changes to the program will continue to leave the agency, the state of Washington, and its taxpayers with an unnecessary level of liability exposure to future lawsuits. Without being proactive now and making these types of legally required adjustments to the program, the agency runs the risk of future efforts that will likely be aimed at shutting down suction dredge mining entirely in the state of Washington, similar to what has already happened in other western states. Washington's current lax regulations and other states' more stringent regulations have caused an influx of miners from around the region. There is very little information currently available to the agency to track the numbers of miners and the locations they're working in or how responsibly they're operating. We also have grave concerns about introduction of invasive species being brought into the state from other regions. Suction dredge mines are known vectors for transporting invasive species such as zebra mussels, and a part of these rule changes should consider inspection of equipment being used in Washington. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Dean. Any questions? Christine Bruner, please, and Paul.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I want to show you a photo that is pertinent to what I'm about to say. Do you mind if I approach?
No, that's okay.
He's not connected to the...
think you all know what this is.
For those that couldn't see the photo, those are the dead baby deer and the dead elk. The one closest to you is the dead elk that's at the bottom photo. I'm a volunteer and a donor for Heaven's Sake Wildlife Rehabilitation Center. Mr. Unsworth, you talk about them being a partner to you and how valuable a service it is for these rehabilitation centers. You know, it's not just deer that they get. It's not elk only. It's so many other animals they get as well. Every kind of bird that Washington State has, including seagulls. I've seen their owls. I've seen, ducks, every kind of duck, geese, muskrat, blue heron, every kind of mammal. They get everything. And these animals, a lot of them come injured, a lot of them don't have a parent. And so the countless hours that these people spend baby bird has to be fed every, I think, 15 minutes. Is that right? Every 15 minutes. So imagine the manpower it takes to get hundreds of these birds, hundreds of animals, and they all come in the spring and into the summer. And so things close down. The shop kind of closed down in the winter. They just keep a lot of these animals through the winter to give them a chance to have a life when they rewild them. Now, I've never worked directly with the animals. I have volunteered with my truck and so forth. What I have seen is that they won't let me near them because they are by the book. They don't want these animals to get habituated on humans. I haven't even met any of these volunteers behind me. But what I do know is that you have a major PR problem on your hands here, that this heavy-handedness, you don't do this to people you call partners. You come in with your SWAT raid, and you raid and kill these animals. Who is going to believe you that this is something that you did out of the kindness of your hearts? There should be someone who's responsible to call the partner first and say, can we discuss this, please? And to take these people who have done everything by the book, I'm at 323 right now, I'm sorry. Anyway, you've got a major PR problem on your hands, and I'm going to help them. I'm a publicist myself. If you come to get the rest of those deer, then watch out, because this is going to go national and international. It will be viral.
Thank you, sir. And questions? Lori Armitage, please, and Jan. Jan.
Okay.
You're up.
My name is Jan White. I'm a veterinarian. I have a wildlife rehabilitation group called Puget Sound Wild Care in Kent. And so I've been actively working with the department since December of 2010. Before that, I worked with the Arizona Game and Fish Department, doing a job consistent with the job that's done by Patricia Thompson in this state. And I learned my craft in California, where I operated a center from 1977. So I've been in this business for about 40-some years. I don't know that you understand very much about your stakeholder here, but we are currently on a criminal model, and what we're going to be asking the department to do is to switch us over to a cooperative model. It makes a huge difference in how these stakeholders can develop the kind of facilities that are desperately needed in Washington State. This is not impossible. It's not difficult. It's not something that's going to cost a lot of money. But we need to take a different approach in how we relate to each other. And I think that the previous speaker pretty much pointed out that when you're on the criminal model, what happens is that you get raided and you have law enforcement people who come and you feel like you need a lawyer. And when you're on a cooperative model, like, for instance, if we were licensed through the health department instead of through the Fish and Game Department, you get a professional investigator who comes out with a written complaint and shows you the complaint with the person's name on it. It's not hidden anymore. And then you have 30 days to respond to the complaint, and there's a discussion. It goes to peer review, not to the judge. And there's a decision that comes back. Now, if it's a really severe problem, it might get referred to a judge, but it doesn't start that way. And I think that there are many, many ways in which we can all work better together. And I just don't think that it's occurred to the existing people that there's another option here. So because I worked in three different states, and I was the original person that developed the IWC standards, which are now part of your WACs, which were never intended to be part of a WAC. They were only intended to be peer review. When I got here and I saw that, I went, holy moly, what does that do to everything? And then it took me a while to realize that everything in the WAC is on the criminal model. It doesn't have to be. There's a better way here. And we want to work with the department to ensure that we have a better system in place, because we have a problem in terms of the number of wildlife rehabilitators. The number is not increasing. The age of the people who are involved is aging. All of these groups that have been having their permits eliminated or trimmed, and there are a number of them, from Spokane and Coosick, Yakima, now Thurston County, Kent's down for the count. Everett went down. This is not something that just happened to For Heaven's Sake. It's happening to a number of people. They're all white. They're all 65 and older. And there's a pattern here. And there's something. There's things that we can do to enhance the profession. And I think the state groups can work with you to try to make that happen. But we have to find a better way forward. I've left you all some written notes for you to confer to.
Thank you, Doctor. And I think your point was very interesting and very well taken. So we appreciate you taking the time to offer that up, and you'll get a call. So Colleen Mayer and Christine, you're up.
Okay. My name is Christine Brunner, and I'm a local CPA here in Olympia, and I am speaking for myself and from my own experience. I started volunteering at For Heaven's Sake Animal Rescue and Rehabilitation in October 2012, and that was 5 years ago, and I've continued up until this October. I have no background in animal biology or care, but because of the orientation, regular trainings, and personal experience working alongside Claudia Sapensky and more experienced volunteers, I eventually was able to handle certain tasks on my own. My respect and admiration for Claudia has grown over the years as I have worked with her and seen her dedication to the animals she cares for. I object to the accusation by the Department of Fish and Wildlife that, For Heaven's Sakes, habituated deer. From the very beginning, it was repeatedly emphasized that wild animals must be kept wild so that we could maximize the success of releasing any rehabilitated animals back into the wild. We were told to limit our contact with animals that were there for rehabilitation to what was necessary to feed, treat, and clean them or their enclosures. In some cases, this did require holding an animal in order to feed it, especially when it was still drinking milk by either bottle, syringe, or tube, or needed to be force-fed. However, as soon as the animal was able to drink or eat on its own, or was weaned, depending on the species, we would back off handling the animal. It was always done in the best interest of the animal and getting them healthy enough for release back into the wild. With respect to deer, this was specifically made clear, as For Heaven's Sake had two imprinted female deer that were permitted to them by the Department of Fish and Wildlife that were used as surrogate mothers to help orphan, injured, or abandoned fawns learn how to browse and feed themselves in the wild. We all knew that these two does would have been euthanized if not for the fact that we could use them to help the fawns that came in every year. As time went on, one of those does became a bit aggressive towards some volunteers, and again, we knew that this was because the doe was not afraid of humans and that this could be dangerous. For Heaven's Sakes, took certain precautions by limiting access to the does. We were constantly reminded we did not want the fawns that came in every year to end up like these does in the sense of being habituated or imprinted. We knew that when deer lose their fear of humans, they become dangerous to humans. Earlier in this year, the more aggressive doe actually killed the other doe, and so that doe had to be euthanized. It was very clear that doe was no longer safe to be around humans. It was sad, but to all of us who worked there for many years, it was very clear what happened. This whole situation re-emphasized to us that For Heaven's Sakes has worked hard to ensure that any fawns that came in as wild were treated as wild so that they could be wild when released. I have more I could say, but at the present time, I want to urge you to make sure that DFW changes the procedures for seizure and euthanization of animals from wildlife rehabilitators. Thank you.
Thank you, Christine. We appreciate your comments. Mary Shaw, please. And Lori?
Hi, my name is Lori Armitage. I have a degree in biology. I have a bachelor's of science in nursing. I'm currently working towards my master's in hospital administration. My children, all three, are in college, and I needed something to do. So I volunteered at For Heaven's Sakes Animal Rescue and Rehab Center. If from the very beginning, from the orientation that David Sapinski provided, and the 23-page volunteer's manual, which I will leave with the commissioners if they desire, it was made clear that these are wild animals. They are to be respected and treated as wild. The department came in following a complaint from three disgruntled interns whom I worked with, Hannah, Faith, and Nathan. They were disgruntled in the fact that they thought interns should be paid. They wanted a full-time job with Claudia, and Claudia doesn't have paid staff. We are fully volunteer staff. They were disgruntled, and it should be noted with Faith, who filed the complaint, also filed a complaint against Critter Care Center, where she was an intern for a brief period of time. Without any due process, the state came in. They took the word of some disgruntled interns, aside from the fact that Claudia and David Sapinski have never had a complaint filed against them. They came in and said an elk and some fawn were habituated. They were not. The elk and deer were still being bottle fed. They are not. The elk and deer will headbutt you to, because that's what they do in the wild to stimulate milk production. This was not an act of being habituated. They were still, as I mentioned before, being bottle fed. And I've lived in Yakima for 12 years and seen the elk on White Pass that are fed. They begin to know when the wagon is coming with the hay. That in no less decreases the wildness of the animal. They are still wild animals, just as the fawn and elk were wild animals. As I mentioned previously, Claudia and David had no complaints filed against them, and I think for the state to come in with no due process, those animals weren't euthanized, they were slaughtered. There was no urgency in this demand. The state had been to, for heaven's sakes, and inspected them on multiple occasions, knew the animals were being fed and appropriately cared for, and so there was no urgency in that. The state has lied. Claudia Sapinski has been an inspiration to me. They have taken in 1,700 animals in 1 year, most of which were returned to the ecosystem where they came from and have gone on to live their full lives. With the closure of Critter Care Center and other essential rehab centers, if this rehab center is treated the way other centers have been treated, and it closes, we're going to lose an essential place where 1,700 animals can be returned to the wild and live a good life. Thank you for hearing my comments today, Commissioner.
Thank you, Laura. Appreciate that. Ron Gardner, please, and Colleen.
My name's Colleen Mayer, and I'm here as myself. I am a volunteer with Puget Sound Wild Care, which previously known as South Sound Critter Care. I wanted to reiterate, I'm not going to actually do it, what Jan said as far as the criminal kind of approach to things, you know, things being coming across as very heavy-handed. One of the things that I just wanted to add a quick reminder to is with our ever-shrinking green space, our interaction with these animals it's much more important for us to have the ability to take things to rehabilitators. If we don't, people will do one of two things. They'll either take them and raise them themselves or try to help them, which can be endangering for the animal and also for the individual. The other choice is to leave the things out there. And when you're dealing with sick and injured animals, it doesn't make sense. It's not good for us to have them left out. It's not like we have a large forest system that they're just kind of rotting and such, but you've got animals and children around that are more likely to come into contact with these animals. So the option of just saying tough beans and leaving them is not a good one, from my perspective. Also, the wildlife rehabilitators do an awful lot in education and letting people know. A lot of times our calls are when we talk to people, we actually encourage them not to bring animals in, because as we discuss things with them, we find out they are essentially very kind-heartedly kidnapping animals that need to be left with the parents. And we're a front line for being able to guard against that. And we also do an awful lot of outreach with educational programs, Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, classrooms, various things where we can also pass on this information. So I think it's very important that we see more support and less conflict, if we can, with the state, so we can do our job better and therefore help you do your jobs better. Thank you.
Thank you, Colleen. Larry Buckland, please. And Mary?
Good morning, Commissioners, and thank you very much for hearing all of us. My name is Mary Shaw. I've been a volunteer at For Heaven's Sake this coming spring for 4 years. In that time, I've received excellent training, education, and hands-on experience from Claudia and David Sapinski. In the past 8 years that David and Claudia have been rehabilitating injured and orphaned wildlife, I have experienced the most amazing people who give up their own time, love, care, patience, and in a lot of cases, their own money. I admire them, and I have the utmost respect for both of them, for their commitment and their sacrifice that they make every single year and at any time of the year. Rehabilitation is a process. For Heaven's Sake, take in hundreds of animals throughout the year. In the spring and the summer, we are very, very busy with injured and orphaned animals who are brought in day and night. I've known Claudia and David to take in animals in the middle of the night. David will leave sometimes late at night to go pick up an injured animal. I've seen them care for the animals all through the night, sometimes getting up every 2 hours to feed, medicate, and check on their new intake. Every year we take in lots and lots of fawn. Some of them are days old, weighing a mere 7 pounds. Scared, cold, hungry, missing their mother, who was possibly struck by a car. Claudia has orchestrated the process of rehabilitation for these little ones for years with a 100% success rate of releasing them back into the wild. We've never had a problem. I have been blessed and fortunate to be involved in the process. As you know, the recent travesty that took place at For Heaven's Sake is a disgrace. A raid that was not they didn't even call to let them, Claudia and David, know they were coming. And Fish and Wildlife took the word of a child volunteer, and was writing reports that were full of lies. Even our biologist lied in her report about all of the fawns running up to her and the officers when they entered their enclosure, breaking their own rules of rehabilitation for 180 days until release. We didn't even get that for those animals. So many lies. Do you think that there could have been an alternative to the recent killing of the fawn and the elk? There aren't many people who are dedicated and to their lives of the and the care of the rehabilitation of Washington's wildlife. I've seen it at For Heaven's Sake. What are we going to do without these nonprofit organizations? Our state biologist certainly isn't going to know how to rehabilitate them. She only has one answer. Let's think of a better way to protect our wildlife in the state of Washington, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Ron Crable, please. And Mr. Gardner. Sir.
Good morning, Commission, Director, and Deputy Director. Nice to see you a third day in a row, Mr. Director. I'm here to report on our Puget Sound Chinook Harvest Management Plan that we've talked about. And I'm glad to see that staff, Kyle Addix, and the Attorney General's Office, Mike Grossman, were able to put a lot of things on the table. It's going to save a lot of time, especially with 3 minutes. One of the things I echo was Commissioner Carpenter's concern with not being brought forward on these on an issue of this magnitude. The commission needs to be apprised of this, and as a major stakeholder, and me being president of the largest fishing organization in Washington State, we have some big concerns. Yesterday, we met with the department, the Attorney General's office, us being the major recreational fishing groups in Washington State, and four commissioners, which I thank you for being there. We quite aren't as optimistic as what the picture was put out there yesterday at this meeting. We have a management plan that's going into place, but what we see as being a problem is the Stillaguamish component of this management plan is very restrictive, and there's a reason why. But even if you were to shut down every fishery on the West Coast, the Stillaguamish River would not recover. It's strictly a habitat water issue. And to put it down as harsh as it is, I think I could see that we could probably work with them and maybe help with the habitat and get it back. But as far as taking a 13% or 15% and dropping it all the way to 8%, which this only four of you probably understand this because we went over this yesterday, it went as a hard cap instead of a target. So it has the possibility of closing down a lot of businesses, manufacturing businesses, loss of jobs, maybe in the tens of thousands, and the quality of life in Washington State. I know this is not an easy issue. I think fisheries in this state are the most complex fisheries in the world. And that's why they're complex, because we're trying to figure out what we can do and what we can't do. And we work with the department and others on a lot of different things. But one of my concerns is when you start, and I really appreciate Governor Inslee starting to ramp up some of the production in the hatcheries to try and help with the orcas. This does help with some of the problems, especially too many seals to feed. But when we start to see license fees start to plummet, if this fishing goes bad, when this starts to go down, we're going to see lack of license sales. You're going to start to see people... You're going to see your budget start to go down, and then legislature is going to start cutting hatcheries. So this is a big, well-rounded problem. It's not just a surface thing, but Washington State is huge into fishing. Salmon fishing is a big driver in this state. So I guess we'll just have to follow up. I do have three sets of paperwork for some of the commissioners that had to leave early yesterday.
Thanks, Ron. Always. Thank you.
Thank you.
Diane Holbrook, please. And Larry, you're up.
Well, I came down with Ron, and quite frankly, after the prior discussions, by the way, thank you for having me here, Larry Buckland with Puget Sound Anglers, Gig Harbor. I've torn up my notes because they provided a lot of clarification, not that I necessarily agree with what was accomplished, but at least I have a better understanding, and for that I'm thankful. However, the Chinook Management Plan, I have to fully support Mr. Carpenter's comments. The commission, you folks, my commission, was established by initiative, and one of your primary duties is policy. This is certainly a 10-year plan is effectively policy. We're going to be working within that broad guideline, and as such, you needed to be involved in this and have a clear understanding, because those folks work for you, you work for me. If you don't understand it, I can't understand it, and we're going to be living within the broad parameters established by that plan, notwithstanding the ability to have some insights as it goes on and open meetings. We're still living within the broad parameters of it. The plan and its entitled improvement, the North of Falcon process, does not eliminate, I'm shifting gears here a little bit, the need to make the North of Falcon process public. That's an ongoing issue. I think you'll hear more about it probably tomorrow. even if that is simply limited to a live feed. I know the issues that are at play, but I have to say we need to have that visibility, not only on this plan, but of the implementations through North of Falcon. And I encourage you to work towards keeping us involved rather than marginalizing your stakeholders. That's all I've got to say. Bell doesn't ring. I'm done. Thank you.
Thanks, Larry. You want the bell to ring just to make it?
No.
Okay, okay. Thank you. Ann Croker, please. And Rob, you're up.
Good morning, Commission. Thank you for this opportunity to provide some public comment. My name is Rob Crable. I'm a Northwest representative with Defenders of Wildlife, and I wanted to stop by today to express that we were encouraged to learn recently that the department is moving forward with requiring a bear identification test for black bear hunters who are going to be getting tags in either of the two grizzly bear recovery ecosystems that we have here in Washington, both the North Cascades and the Selkirks. Hunters, as you all know, are a very important co-manager and steward of a lot of our wildlife species. But unfortunately, because black bears and grizzly bears can look a lot alike, there are sometimes accidental shootings that happen. And with two very small populations of grizzly bears in the state, any level of incidental take of a grizzly bear is going to have a big impact on these populations. Washington is currently the only state with grizzly bears that doesn't require this hunter identification test, so we think that it's an important step that the state can take in the right direction to further educate our hunters and involve them more in the co-management of this species. We have been working really closely to educate hunters as well, especially out in Ponderay County. We've been working very closely with WDFW staff on providing more education about bear identification, the use of bear spray, and how to avoid conflict to begin with through things like our electric fencing incentive program. I also wanted to comment that we are encouraged by a lot of the things that the department is doing when it comes to southern resident orcas. This is one of the top priority species for our organization. It's an animal that is loved throughout the state of Washington and is in dire need of some help. So we are fully supportive of the department's efforts moving forward and are looking forward to working with you on ways to increase the amount of Chinook, coho, and chum salmon available to these whales. They're the ones that these orcas will go after. And then also, Director Unsworth, you had mentioned that the department would be looking at issues with toxics and the full impacts of them. We just released a report about a month ago fully detailing the impacts that toxic pollution has on orcas, which includes decreasing birth rates, increasing infant mortality rates, and a whole host of different problems. So I've shared this with other folks in the department. Happy to share some copies with the commission and you as well. So thank you.
Yeah, Rob, that would be very helpful if you could.
Yeah, I don't know if I have enough copies for everyone, but I will leave some copies for the commission. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lori Johnson, please, and Diane or Diana? Diane.
Okay. Hi, and thank you all for letting us speak today. I really do appreciate the responsiveness you've had to the outcry about the incident, for heaven's sake. I appreciate that you are considering changing your policies in this way. I'm going to repeat a lot of what other people have said, at least in sentiment. Over the years, I have known David and Claudia Sapinski and have seen them act with passion, skill, and heart in the cases of injured and orphaned animals, from squirrels to songbirds and hawks, owls, eagles, and, of course, many hundreds of fawns. Every year they care for many fawns, and every year Claudia tries to take care of the fawns while also trying to educate the public on when the fawns need rescue and when they don't. Without people like Claudia and the other rehabbers in the process, people will make mistakes, and they will try to do this work themselves to the harm of both the people and the wildlife. That will be the outcome of your actions. You won't stop people from trying to help. And you won't get better people for the jobs that, for heaven's sake, does by abusing the people who do this work and give their life to this work. I still boggle at the thought processes that led to the killing of the fawns and the elk, for heaven's sake, over the objections of Claudia and the discussion that must have taken place between supposedly educated and experienced people. it is, as someone said previously, the wrong approach to come in as a law enforcement kind of action instead of a collaborative sort of action. I hope by now you realize this was a huge mistake, in my opinion. Anyone that would treat Claudia this way is in the wrong job. Anyone at Fish and Wildlife who doesn't realize this was a huge mistake is in the wrong job. You wasted the babies, but worse yet, you wasted the life energy of really good people who have invested their time, effort, and heart into these babies. The animals deserved a chance, but Claudia and David deserved your respect and your restraint. To cruelly disregard them and waste their efforts is evil, frankly. There's no way to sugarcoat it. Those people did not deserve to be treated this way, and we need more people willing to do what, for heaven's sake, and A Soft Place to Land and the other rehabbers here today do, not less, not fewer of these organizations, more of them. We need a process for improving the way these facilities and inspections and decisions get made. I'll leave the details up to the rehabbers and yourselves for how to go about that process. But a peer review process and some best practices designed by rehabbers that are in this business would greatly improve, I think, the collaborative effort between the department and the rehabbers and that are doing this work. So please make these changes and change this process. We won't forget what happened. And if these people are lost and no longer doing this kind of work, they will be missed. They are treasures to our community and to our wildlife.
Thank you, Diane. Appreciate that. Jasmine Glaze, please. And Anna? Yeah,
hi, I'm Ann.
It was one of the two.
You're one of
the
two. I'm Ann Craker. Thank you, Commissioners and Director, for listening to my comments. I'm speaking as myself, but my background is I've been 20 years in conservation and also the past year plus on the Wildlife Diversity Advisory Council. So it's been really wonderful to be part of because I was interested in the programs of WDW before, but now I've learned so much, and I've also come to the commission meetings and started to talk to a couple of you and get to know a lot more of what you do and what the programs are through the council. So I understand also a lot, just coming here, you understand challenges too, and I appreciate how much we are all working together for our state. I'm going to address the newly formed Budget Proviso Committee, and I sent a letter to this, just FYI, to Jim Unsworth and also to a couple of others. I probably didn't get everybody correctly because I couldn't figure out who might be the right people to address. Only recently at our council meeting, I saw who the members were, and it first struck me that there was a very low percentage of women. I didn't understand that, and then I started to wonder, well, is there, you know, the rest of diversity? I didn't understand that. I'm glad you're working on that within the department, but that seemed a problem. And then I started looking at the content of who was representing what, and that also didn't seem to me correct from what I've understood WDFW2 programs to undertake. So I realize I'm reading a lot more about the proviso, and I realize the state mandate tells you one thing. You just had your first meeting. There are a lot of nuances, but I'm fearing that this budget is going to help define the next few years how our state public wildlife and health for conservation is going. And since that is your first mission, I'm not seeing that reflected in the people in the advisory group. I do not know what their power is or what they're going to be doing, but that from the outside was of concern to me. I have a lot more detail, but I don't really need to get into that. I had that some in the letter, but I can certainly talk to any of you or anyone on the committee afterwards to get into more of my thoughts. That was it.
Thank you, Anna. Well stated. Yes. Yeah. Could we get a copy of the letter? Who did
absolutely.
You
absolutely.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah. Okay, thank you.
And I would give that to
Tammy back there.
Or Tina out in the hall is fine.
Yeah.
That would be great. Thank you.
So we can make copies for all of us. Thank you. Don Wallace, please. And Lori.
Thank you. My name is Lori Johnson. I am not a volunteer for Heaven's Sake Wildlife, but I am a volunteer with Feline Friends Cat Rescue. I have known David and Claudia since the beginning of For Heaven's Sake. I've been at several nonprofit events with them, working alongside of them. I have taken injured birds out to them numerous times, and every time I went out there, I was not allowed to go in the back, even though I'm friends with these people, because they don't want humans to be imprinted on these animals. Their existence in life is these animals, as well as the other rehabbers, I believe, as well. When I first heard about what happened out there that day, I was terribly disappointed in the state of Washington for where I live. And then after I listened to a radio program that there was interviews with other rehabbers, I was disgusted and beyond disappointed. It's just horrible what happened. And it seems to me that the approach is they just terrorize these people. They go out there and do whatever they want. I mean, I'm sure glad my neighbor can't call the police and say, hey, Lori's doing this over at her house, and they come and bust through my door and arrest me. That's pretty much the same thing. There needs to be some kind of a due process. You have some young woman who's uneducated, and she's disgruntled because she's not getting her own way, making up these fictitious lies, and you take her word for it? Really? I don't get that. There needed to be some kind of investigation to see if there was any validity to this complaint, and there wasn't. And to take those little animals and kill them, I'd like to know how those people slept that night. I mean, that's just beyond me. It seems like your first line of to do anything with animals is to kill them. Let's kill a bear because it's being a bear, you know. You don't give Claudia and David enough credit for all their experience. You just go out there and bust out there and take those animals, and that was just really wrong. You all work for us, the citizens of Washington, and you need to take this in serious consideration to change the way this is going on. Those little animals didn't have a voice. I do. I am their voice, as well as these other people here that are speaking. Thank you.
Thank you. Dan Bohert, please. I'm sorry. And Jasmine, good to see you 2 days in a row.
Is it working? My name is Jasmine. I'm the rehabilitator, director, founder of A Soft Place to Land Wildlife Rehabilitation Center. You've heard a lot about the individual specifics of individual cases going on, and so I'm going to kind of stick to what I see as actually being the problem. I think what's going on is more of a symptom. I do want to say that, you know, I do respect and appreciate the role that Fish and Wildlife Department plays in wildlife rehabilitation. I'm concerned that maybe that's not a two-way thing. I have twice this morning, once on a radio show on the way here, and in some comments made by Director Unsworth, her comments that kind of point to us as being too emotional, that's clouding our judgment, or that the public is hearing from rehabilitators who may be biased because of their interactions with the state. And I can tell you that, sure, I'm emotionally invested, but I am also very capable of removing that away and making logical decisions. I have to decide to euthanize animals that come in, and I'm able to do that. I have actually only had positive interactions with the department, with the staff, with enforcement officers. I have never had a negative interaction with them, and yet when this came up and I had concerns about our rights and what was going on, I didn't feel that I could even come out and speak to that without I requested to inactivate my license, and I closed my facility. And I've never had a negative interaction at all. Nothing but positive interactions with the state, and I still didn't feel I could do it. I'm closed. I do not rehab right now. You know, the big problem is the fact that you're hearing two very different accounts from both sides. very different accounts, which would not even be an issue had any of this been heard before a neutral, impartial review board. Some kind of due process. You would have it on the record what both sides had to say, the facts, the, you know, what they brought to the table, and you could review the cases. The determination would have been made by somebody who doesn't have ties to either side, and it would have been fair one way or the other. You know, sometimes, yes, enforcement action needs to be taken, and there's nothing wrong with that. But do we really want this to continue in a way where there are no limitations, there is no opportunity for a rehabber to answer to the violations that they're being told there are? They can't present evidence. There's no official record. You actually have no idea what really happened because you're hearing just he said, she said. And I guess that's time. So thank you.
Thank you. And I
do encourage you, though, just real quick, because it's such a big issue, I do encourage you maybe after this to just do some investigation on your own and look into to what's going on.
And I hope you will reconsider your closing in a future date, too.
If I have protections, I will be right back to rehabbing, and I hope that you guys can help enable me to get back to doing that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kaplan Keith Robbins, please. And Don.
I'm still Don Wallace. I'm here to the third meeting I've been to, and I, listening to all this, I'm amazed at what you guys have to go through and what you have to deal with. It's pretty great decisions you have to make, so appreciative of that, and I have no great expectations of any results from what I keep presenting to you, but eventually you will all agree with me. That's a certainty in my mind. Because in your hearts and your minds, you're gonna know that I'm absolutely right that it's dangerous to ban the American Dipper. Like I say, you guys have to make a lot of great decisions. To stop banning the American Dipper, though, that will be a monumental decision because it will have greater repercussions in the bird banding world. That's why I don't have great expectations, because it's going to be a very tough thing for you guys to do because of the repercussions that will follow eventually. But with that being said, I won't stop until I know you're all on my side. So you can be sure of that. That's all I have to say this morning, other than thank you.
Thank you, Matt. And I can say your tagline, you're stuck with me. Donnie Dipper. I mean, I'll never forget you. So. And please keep reminding us, okay? So, okay. Stephen Willis, please. And Dan.
Good morning. Dan Boholt. I've been a volunteer for the Department of Fish and Wildlife for 35 years. I've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly. This killing of innocent rehab wildlife was the ugliest. This policy needs to change. I can help facilitate this. I have a lot of ideas. I've been in contact with the rehabbers. So I think we can work on this. 17 years ago, I was sitting right here at this table. I'd had a five-month battle with the Olympia Department of Fish and Wildlife over the first ever game management plan. We successfully got that plan in a good state. I told the commissioners at that time I could go back to being one of your biggest supporters, or I could continue to fight with Olympia Department of Fish and Wildlife. Every one of those commissioners said they wanted me to go back to being a supporter, and changes were made. So I've been in rehab myself. I have Lyme disease. I've been fighting it for 26 years. I only learned about it 6 years ago, so I haven't been able to keep an eye on this agency. I'm now doing better. I'm starting to see the same things I saw 17 years ago, and so I'll give you a couple examples. Recently, in Region 6, there was a secret meeting held to try to turn units into four-point black-tailed deer. I found out about it, called the staff. I was lied to. We finally got it out in the public, and we got this stopped. This is wrong. Some of the staff continues to lie to us. Some of the staff is setting policy. That's your job, not the staff's job. This has all come to head with the killing of these four innocent wildlife, so things need to change. So I worked on getting this commission style set up, brought it to the voters, we voted it in. This is the best style of wildlife commission there is. There was a study done. I gave it to Director Keening 17 years ago. He said, this is what I'm trying to convince the staff. And so we've got the best commission we've got. But the staff has to be honest to you and honest to us. And that's what we need to work on. So I'm going to try and help with that. I have a bill going in the legislature this year. And it's pretty simple. It says if you're a government employee and you lie to the public, you lie to the legislature, you lie to a board or to a commission, you're fired. I have tremendous support for this. I'm quite confident it's going to pass. And one legislator told me if we get this passed, the legislative session will be half as long as it usually is.
And the jails will be fuller.
So anyways, I look forward to helping you fix things for the public and the wildlife.
Thank you, Dan. And look forward to also getting that support from Grays Harbor Foundation for our youth initiative. Crystal Elliott, please, and Kaplan.
Commission and Director, thank you for giving me the opportunity to voice my concerns about the representation that the sport fish community is getting from the Department of Fish and Wildlife and regulations negotiations with the co-managers. I'm going to give you three examples that concern me greatly. First of all, I'm a licensed captain and fishing guide in Puget Sound and have been for 26 years. I've been involved in the North Falcon process for over 20. I have been laughed out of the North Falcon process for 3. And I have a couple of things that have been passionate to me. One, for example, is the catch and release season that existed in Puget Sound for the last, since 2001 until this season, and it got shut down. It was a 30-day catch and release season. It started out as a 4-year pilot program. The department did lots of research on it as a possibility of the future expanding catch and release in Puget Sound, as catch and release is a management tool that the whole rest of the fishing community uses. Puget Sound had one catch and release season. It expanded. It started out 2 weeks in December. That was obviously not very well attended. It expanded to 2 weeks in June. It was lightly attended, very well monitored, and expanded to 4 weeks in June. It's been in place since 2003, in the whole month of June. It was ripped out from under us this season for no reason other than, from my understanding, the co-managers didn't like catch and release. Has nothing to do with the computer model. It has been attacked within the department, within the sport fishing community, trying to get a few extra fish, a few extra days for harvest. I understand that, but it's always passed the red face test until this year when co-managers decided they didn't like it. So that's one example, and not getting pushback from the department. There's two others. One was also an introduction to a 3-day wild harvest of Chinook salmon in Puget Sound that happened this year. So we lost 30 days of non-harvest and got 30 days of catch and release, and we opened 3 days of wild harvest inside Elliott Bay. During the North and Falcon meetings, everyone in the room was against the wild harvest to a T. Every single person that spoke up said, we do not support wild harvest in Elliott Bay. what did we get? We got wild harvest in Elliott Bay. It's been swept under the rug. There's not been a lot of conversation about it. There's been no wild harvest in Puget Sound for, I'm guessing, 8 years, 10 years inside the inner Puget Sound. And this one was a big slap in the face to the sport fishing community and all of us that have supported the department's efforts to increase selective harvest and to encourage people to release wild fish. And now it's sending a mixed message that now we can harvest wild fish. So thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Kathleen. Appreciate it. Bonnie Bellini, please. And Stephen?
Stephen, yeah. I'm Steve Willis, and I'm a farmer in the lower Chehalis-Satsup River Valley. And my concerns are really to protect our land. Our land soil down in that Chehalis Valley is probably, this dirt is probably twice the depth of this room here. So each time we lose an acre of land, we got 25,000 cubic yards roughly going into the Chehalis River of nothing but dirt. Then at the end of that, 15 miles downstream, the Corps of Engineers has to maintain a shipping channel at the cost of millions of dollars every year. So that puts our ports at a disadvantage because they have to do the maintenance on maintaining a shipping channel because all that dirt settles into that shipping channel and they have to pick it up in a barge boat and dump it out in the middle of the ocean. So we lost this land. It was probably created during the last ice age, even before the Native Americans arrived on this land. And I'm just, you know, so upset. Every time I see something like this going on, it upsets me. You look at the sky on Skagit River right now where they're losing that land in Lyman. It's all because that gravel bar is built up on that main channel of the river, and it forced that river over into that land that was there for centuries. And if we can maintain and maybe even enhance Chinook habitat by taking that gravel bar, dig a hole, eventually, you know, the next flood event, the water will flow into that water hole, and you got to, you know, the holes that the Chinook salmon need to survive on right now, then. And you're taking the dirt out of the river, which unless the fish eat the dirt, I know the price of food for the fish is going up, but I don't think they eat the dirt. We need to save that dirt on our land. And another thing was the Oso landslide. You could easily see where that gravel bar was building up at the end of Steelhead Drive, and they had the log revetment that was eroding underneath that and digging a hole. And all these logs were tied together, and the hole was there, and that triggered the landslide, was that revetment and that hole in that river on the end of that toe of that hillside, and just literally ripped that hillside all out from underneath that. You know, and they sent 80,000 cubic yards of dirt down that Stillaguamish. And you wonder why don't we have any fish in the Stillaguamish? Well, I mean, you do things like that, it's going to happen. Where if you would have taken that gravel bar and put a hole there, it would have been a fish habitat, and all that dirt would have never gone into that river. And then you got the guy that was in the Army that got his house hit. He was out there with an excavator tearing his house down because it was going to go into the Nisqually River. And that dirt, as soon as I got done with that excavator on the Nisqually, I would have turned my excavator around, taking that dirt where the bank's going to go into the river, and literally start putting that dirt into the river, because that's what we're doing, really, is all we're doing is putting that dirt into the rivers. And, you know, they're filling up. I mean, there's two bridges on the Satsup right now that are going to be endangered, highway bridges that are going to endanger of going, you know, being taken out by this river, and we're going to have to spend millions of dollars on that. The port of Grays Harbor that has an industrial park on the hill with a water well, that water well is going to have to be either moved or protected at millions of dollars every year to fix it. And then there's a sewage treatment plant down in Montesano. It's the same thing. It's right across from Fish and Wildlife land that's, you know, filling in with gravel, and it's going to push it over into the, in, you know, in maybe endanger that sewage treatment plant going into the water and all that sewage going into the water at that point. Okay. And I'd sure like to see something happen as far as being able to take a little bit of gravel out and, you know, enhance habitat and protect our lands and buffer zones and everything else. And I welcome, I mean, everybody, well, we've always welcomed fishermen and hunters on our land with no cost whatsoever. So I would just hope we could protect our land in the future.
Thank you, Stephen. Appreciate your comments. And Robert Suter, please. And Crystal, you're up.
Good morning, commissioners. Good morning, director and deputy director. Thanks so much for the opportunity to provide public comment today. My name is Crystal Elliott. I'm the Washington State Habitat Director for Trout Unlimited. And I'd just like to kind of reiterate the remarks that were made earlier with regard to Trout Unlimited's recent petition for rulemaking regarding suction dredge mining regulations here in Washington State. We feel very strongly that the current regulations are not protective enough of our native fish species, particularly our ESA-listed bull trout, salmon, and steelhead. So we really appreciate your willingness to review this petition, and we're happy to engage and answer any questions as we move forward with that. So thank you for your time. Really appreciate it.
Always good to see TU here. Thank you. And Mark Isaac, please. And Bonnie.
My name is Bonnie Malani. I was a volunteer for heaven's sakes up until August when I had to take a leave to go back to school. I was planning on returning over winter break when all of this happened, and it was very saddening to me to find out what happened. You know, I spent a lot of time during the spring and summer working with those animals, and at no time did I ever treat any of those animals as pets, nor did I feel that they were habituated. They were not tame. And I'm in the forestry program at Grays Harbor College. My goal is somewhere to land within wildlife management. This was an injustice. I don't want to be a part of that program. You know, that was a slap to the volunteers, to Claudia, and it was totally wrong for those animals. We are their voice. We are supposed to be a team that work together, not have a raid on our facility and those animals be executed for no reason. Due process should have been granted. They should have sent someone out to investigate. You know, without getting too emotional, because that was a place for me to go. It helped me with school. If it had not been for Claudia and David, I may not have gone into the forestry program. You know, now it's making me look at my decision a little more closer. I don't know if I want to continue this. So thank you for hearing me, and I hope we can resolve this.
Well, thank you, and as a former dean, you call me. We're not going to let you drop out of this program. All right? I'm serious. I'm going to give you my number. If you have any questions, you call me.
Okay.
I'll put on my old dean hat again.
Okay.
You didn't see that.
Yeah, the instructor's not too happy about it either.
No. You see me at break after this, and I'm serious. You don't go anywhere. We need people like you in the field. You know, you're the future. So. And you're going to have a lot of disappointments in your life. It's how you deal with those disappointments. You know, how you pick yourself up. And you've heard a lot of positive things today.
Yes.
Take all of that to heart. And then you call me.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Robert.
Thank you, Commissioners. Robert Sudart, Commercial Advisor for the Columbia River. And I'm sorry that the director didn't get a chance to talk about the pound nets today, because that's part of what I want to talk about. I sent you a letter this week voicing a lot of my concerns about that. We don't have any doubts that they can catch fish. We just have questions about how they're being applied on the river and the expectations of what they can accomplish. I see where they're going to be testing them in the spring. There's two things that control harvest in the spring. It's the ESA limits of impacts, and also catch balancing. And typically, catch balancing with the tribes is what shuts down any of the fisheries first, not the ESA impacts. So the commercial, you've whittled down the commercial share so far, it pretty much all gets used up in the select areas now. Even if they had a 0% mortality rate in the spring, it still is going to be restricted by the cap, the catch balance cap. I don't know who you think are going to be providing those fish unless you're willing to cut back the recreational fishery to do it. If they were after the tribes, it might be different, but they're fishing in front of the tribes. That's going to be your limit. In the summer, you don't have any ESA Chinook. You've got ESA steelhead and sockeye. And the trap's going to be really good at catching those sockeye because they travel on the beach. There's only about 1,000 fish in the whittled down commercial sector there based on the run size last year, and it's about the same size this year. Most of that harvest is reserved for the upper river, not for the lower river. So once again, what are they going to be fishing for? The reason this concerns me the most is because your RCW says 77.50.030, before any of this happens with a new fishery, you're supposed to be consulting. The director must consult with the commercial fishing interests that would be affected by the trial or experimental fishery permit. That's never happened. We've never been introduced into that conversation. The trap was in place before we even knew about it. And you're having more meetings with the trap people. We're never involved in those. We don't know what your plan is. Maybe your plan is just to show that it doesn't work in the spring and summer. You know, that's fine. But as the industry that's on the table on this whole thing, we should have been involved. Your RCW says we should have been involved, and you're just not doing that. In the fall season, they handled 1,000 steelhead at that trap. 200 of them were wild. Even at their 5% rate, that's 10 dead wild steelhead. Even if only one of them was a wild bee, that's a poorer return than what our gillnet fishery did in terms of avoiding wild bee steelhead. You know, I'm frustrated by how this is going and what the expectations are and the fact that we're not in the conversation. And finally, in terms of the orca conversation, the Columbia River production of Chinook is well documented as an important part of their diet. And if you expand that, you're going to need to be able to harvest some of those fish, and we're the fishery in Washington that doesn't impact the orcas because we're fishing after the fish come back in the river where the orcas don't go. So,
thank you, Robert. Larry's got one question.
Yeah, sure. Any
thank
questions?
You comments, Robert. Just in the spirit of letting you know, the PowerPoint and briefing that they provided at our last meeting is the only communication or dialogue that the commission has had with them. There's been no meetings. It's just an opportunity to learn about what's new, what may or may not be of value. Don't know, but that's all it was. So just want you to know that.
Well, they had to get a certain amount of permitting from the department to do this. It did, and they've had a biologist from the department assigned to them. So the department has had an involvement. I'm not saying the commission has known about it, but the department has been involved. And your RCW says we were supposed to be involved in that conversation, too. And we haven't been, and we still aren't. So I understand what you're saying, and I appreciate that.
Yeah. Don's got a question, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks for the testimony, Robert. I was writing, and I wasn't quite sure I got this correct. So you mentioned something about B-run steelhead impacts in the pound net versus B-run steelheads in the entire fleet for the zones 4 and 5 fishery?
Yeah, so this fall, the constraining stock wasn't salmon, it was wild bee steelhead. And we were assigned 30% of the 2%, and that all worked out to about 7 wild bee steelhead that we could have as mortalities in our commercial fishery. And that was in 7 openings, 5 in August and 2 in September. And this is where you had the observer program. About 20% of our boats were observed during the fishery. And the determination was that we caught 19,000 Chinook and had about 6 wild bee mortalities in our that's what the model said. There weren't actually any observed wild bee mortalities, but based on the expansions, that's what they came up with. 6, and we were allowed 7. So we were shut down after those 7 opening. The trap caught 1,000 steelhead in the heart of the bee run, which we were not fishing in. They had almost 200 of those that were wild. So if 5% of those wilds are mortalities based on their own numbers in their presentation, then they had about 10 wild mortalities, or let's say non-clipped mortalities. There's a lot of things that are in there. There could be some A's. We know that there are quite a few hatchery fish that aren't clipped. But even if there was only one real wild bee in their 10 mortalities, that's still a poor return at their 20-some hundred Chinook than what we caught in our gillnet fishery. That's the point I'm trying to make. I keep harping on the selectivity thing. There's lots of ways to measure that. And the testing showed that we were very selective this year.
Thank you, Robert. Thank you very much. And Mark, you have the last word of the morning.
Wow, that's a hard act to follow. I'm Mark Izett. I'm down in Hoquiam. I hear my sources say you guys are relatively impartial. That makes me feel really good. I'm more here for a historical perspective about wildlife rehab. I started Olympic Wildlife Rescue in McCleary in the mid-80s. And if you guys were here reading the Daily O, you probably read about us because one of our board members was on the Daily O. He got just about once a month front page stuff. And we also had a very charismatic director. And so after all these meetings, they go to him with the microphone. So we were in the center of everything. Now, I'm going to slightly change the subject. Dr. Richard Tabor from the University of Washington. How many of you guys know that name? Any of you guys raise your hand? Now, for the audience, he was a professor of ungulates emeritus at the University of Washington. I think that he was the number one authority in the state of Washington. And a lot of your agents got their degrees from him, especially back in my day. They all had got their degrees from him. So all of us started out respecting the agents, but they told me things like, we have no expertise, we have no education on this, you're not a priority to us, we've got no money for you, you have no effect on the population, we know that, okay, not really, you're basically a waste of time. And then in the next sentence, they'd be telling us exactly how to do things when we probably know more than they did. We know certainly did. Okay, now never mind that we were nobodies, that we were educating kids. We were practicing for what really mattered, and we did get endangered species. So we did certainly make an impact. So me and Sean Newman, the state attorney at the time, who's now a professor at the universities, we started battling. And these are guys I used to respect. So then the one day, the call came, and it was January. We're going to come out and release all your fawns, which were born in April. And the director called me, what do I do? And I said, don't let them on the property. Call the sheriff. I'm calling the press. And then give me a few hours. So I tracked down Dr. Tabor. Now, I admit I got lucky because I had the right guy. He said, well, of course you release them in the spring. It's common sense. That's what I thought. And then I asked the big question, will you write a letter? And I figured he'd say no, politics. He said yes. And he sent it. It was like a shockwave went through the Department of Wildlife. And then all we heard was silence. And then I found out the entire staff I was working with had gotten their degree from him, and they couldn't really deny that letter. And that letter might still be in your archives someplace. I don't know. If I was, I might have thrown it away. So I inadvertently shoved the knife right in the heart. I became sort of famous in the wildlife department. They left us alone for most of 2 years. And so anyway, I've been watching these Gestapo tactics go on for 30 years. We definitely need change. Now, you might ask, why would they call us and ask to release the deer in January? We know why. They were showing us who was in charge. They wanted us to make sure that they, and so it's, and I got one last thing. This will really interest you. Your Region 6 director was on our radio program this morning, and somebody called him, not me, and cornered him and said, when is the optimum time to release young deer? He wouldn't answer. He asked again. And he wouldn't answer. It depends on the species. Oh, come on. Then he says, well, I can't answer that. I do not have a wildlife degree. So they won't even answer the question. He knows when you release them. I mean, you can ask an eighth grade class, when would you release a fawn? Well, at the beginning of the food cycle, right? And so I heard they're trying to make people release them in September. That might be okay. I don't know. But January, November, it's all politics. So let's change some laws.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you. Well, we appreciate the comments, and you've provided excellent testimony and public input. And believe me, for all of us, we do listen to what you say, and your time was well spent sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Smith, would you want a copy of the handbook?
I would, please. Thank you. And at that time, we're going to take a 10-minute break, and then we will reconvene. And again, thank you very much.